This is January 1, 1992. We're at the home of Bill Stark on Fifth Avenue, continuing our interview for the National Council of Jewish Women. This is Howard Braun and Flo Joseph. Bill, will you say a word so we can hear your voice?
I'll be very happy to participate. Thank you.
I don't think we talked about the Young Presidents organization. What did you want to say about it?
What I was interested in telling you was talking about the formation of this organization that continues to live now some 22 years later. What happened was Ray Hickok, whose father was in the manufacturing of belts in New York State, his father died when he was 25 or 26 years old and left him with this large business, and immediately tried to make some connections to other young friends of his to help him understand what his responsibility was. And he started an organization called the Young Presidents Organization late 1950, early 1951. Among the Pittsburghers who he contacted were Al Rockwell, who at that time was president of Rockwell Manufacturing, which eventually became North American Rockwell, and S. Murray Rust, who was the president of Rust Engineering, and they were contemporaries of his in their late 30s. The Young Presidents Organization now has at least 2,000 members and maybe 3,000 alumni. I was privileged to become a member in 1951, which was the first year of its organization in Pittsburgh. It was an exciting organization because most of us had similar problems, A, with a domineering father, or B, running a business at a very early age because of death in the family and or other things. One-third of us were involved in family-owned businesses. One-third of us started our own business, and one-third of us married the boss's daughter. It was quite a fascinating experience because here we were all groping for a growing-up process, each supporting the other. The national meetings were fantastic, where you had Margaret Mead, one meeting I attended, a second meeting involving Carl Menninger, and we thirdly concerned ourselves with family development. And to this day, 1992, there are at least 35 young Pittsburgh men who still belong to this organization. You have to get out at age 49. You have to be president of your company before your 38th birthday. And of course, at the time, I was 31. So it was quite a comfort for me to be able to lead my family group and find kindred souls, Aaron Levinson, Joe Katz, and others, Ray Rakoff, American Shear Knife, and so many other Christian youngsters who otherwise never would have had a chance to meet. And over the years, we were able to do community things together in the Civic Light Opera, in the Lighthouse, and in the Pittsburgh Symphony, and so on.
Would you like to say something special about Rakoff? Just happens to be interesting. You know?
Well, Rakoff, I was at his bar mitzvah. His brother and I were close friends, and he subsequently married Ben Weinberg's daughter and became president of American Shear Knife, expanded it to a European operation in Belgium. We've remained friends ever since, and it was quite a experience. Uh-huh. In fact, his wife cried when I had to retire. Because my swan song speech was so touching, how important this was to us. Their son now belongs, and many of my friends have sons who are second generation members of this wonderful organization. It gives you a chance to do some social good because these fellows find out that others have similar aspirations for building a better world. And to me, this is the secret of our survival in the American capitalist system.
Turn that off. Hello. you mentioned the drum corps that you were trying to get going currently for the purpose of, I don't want to review it, but how about telling us this project you're on?
Well,
right,
this is the latest project. Really, it's been 10 years since I tried to work with drum corps, which is a very highly disciplined form of music training for young people. And this junior drum corps is called the Enforcers. It was initiated by the Police Athletic League this time.
Enforcers.
Yeah. And initially we were the junior drum corps, and we were knocked out of business about 8 or 9 years ago. Mayor Caligiuri would help us by providing the insurance on the car that transported our kids on the instruments on anybody getting hurt. When he died, we lost that city support, and we were in limbo. We're now back in business because the Police Athletic League decided to start drum corps again, and I've been able to get support from Wendy's, and we are getting transportation donated by a yellow cab. Richard Tellerico is the president there, and now we're back with, we're using the county park at North Park for our training on Saturdays and Sundays. This is an excellent discipline. Our program now is designed to take 300 kids off the street this summer and train them in drum corps, picking the best 60 to be what we call an A corps that will compete east of the Mississippi with other cities. It's a discipline wherein you can earn money by your finishes in these competitions. The kids sell hoagies to help pay part of their costs. Parents are involved. It's just a wonderful institution because it teaches physical discipline and music discipline, because you've got to master the instrument and you also have to march at the same time and memorize the music. And of course, the best among our students will be offered scholarships to Duquesne. We've got the mayor's office interested, because we think we'll rehearse either at the Shemley Park, because there's a federal food program for feeding kids in the summer that we could take advantage of, and or rehearse down on Washington Boulevard because it's a central location.
Who's the chairman of this
activity? Basically, he's relying on me to raise the money.
Who?
Chester Friedman, who is a retired police officer in Aspinwall, who believes that if we would stop throwing money at the drug control and start putting money into getting kids to get involved in proper activities like scouting and drum corps, that we could put an end to the drug problem in this country, at least in the next generation. We fight with the U.S. attorney, and he makes promises which he doesn't keep. In the meantime, we continue to drive to get kids involved, because we believe that that's the ultimate solution of the drug problem among young people. It's an exciting opportunity to meld the government facilities with the private sector, where I'm trying to get. The Giant Eagle has made tremendous contributions, and we're trying to stay together with the private sector melding with the public sector.
Your artwork is
that's not significant in terms of it's only a personal interest. It's not of a historical significance.
You say your art is not of historical significance.
No, not to strangers.
Not to strangers. Well, why is it a significant? Why do you like it?
I think because it just gives me a chance to enhance my personal growth as a human being.
Uh-huh. And why do you care what it's worth?
I only care what it's worth in the sense that I would like to preserve it for future generations' use and the pleasure of other people. I'm not sure how much my children are interested. There are a couple of pieces that I would like to donate to public purposes. That piece of Swedish lead sculpture out there, I'm trying to determine whether that would be something that maybe, I want to put that on the lawn at the Pittsburgh Center for the Arts.
Uh-huh.
And the two seasons that go back to 1894, I'd love to put somewhere where they could be enjoyed by other people.
Mm-hmm.
Is that
it is, yes, it's very
very hard to get your children to be enthusiastic
about any of the things that I'm interested in. That's
interested
true.
In. I have they shown any interest in any of it?
Oh, yes, they are. I think they have an appreciation, but it's not nearly as measurable as mine is. I have a trumpet sitting here that I tried to show my grandson the other day, but he wasn't interested. He played the thing as a fifth grader in grade school with the Redcoats at Shadyside, and they played at the Three Rivers Arts Festival, and I thought, boy, that would snare him. It didn't work.
You never missed the Symphony concert for 50 years.
I didn't miss the Symphony concert from 1934 to at least 1970. I never missed a Symphony
concert. Did you get to know Previn at all?
No. My brother knew him. He was younger than I, and he played at Peabody. No, he was not. He was just about 10 years behind.
How about Steinberg? You mentioned
I got to meet Steinberg at an airport in Europe while he was studying the score. And he lived on Squirrel Hill Avenue. It was a wonderful human being, but it wasn't for a very long period. But there were about 10 musicians in that orchestra in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s with whom I played in high school. And
who were they?
Well, you had the second violin, second chair, and you had three or four fellows in the violin section that I knew over a period of time.
You were bass at that time.
I was a bass viol player, but they went on to become professional musicians, which my mother didn't think was an appropriate life for me. But we met at different places for different reasons. And just 3 weeks ago, I talked to Frank Gorell, who played French horn for Reiner, and we were able to reminisce. And I played bridge with Sidney Kaufman.
Yes.
Sidney Kaplan, who's the business manager of the symphony now, and a very fine French horn player. Strange phenomenon about French horn players. It seems that their life expectancy in the symphony might maximize at 10 years. We've had about 12 or 13 of them in my lifetime, and it's a shame, but most of them retired after 10 years of play. You'll notice that every famous orchestra, every significant orchestra has an assistant for the first French horn player, because there's a limit to the physical strength that they can impart to that instrument that requires them to be relieved instantaneously by a fifth player, so that there are basically four French horn parts written in a symphony, but there are always five players.
Never knew that.
And that's one of the reasons for the fifth player to relieve the head man. But the present French horn player is an incredible young man, probably the best I've ever heard. Caballero, he will solo at the Pittsburgh Symphony Concert on May the 3rd of 1992. And I have to tell you, that's the reason I'm coming back from Florida early to hear him perform.
Well, what about the bass section?
The bass section is basically undistinguished for many years.
Yes, it still is.
It's still undistinguished, except they now have two young men who make a difference. In my time, Bianco was the principal. As a matter of fact, Steinberg had him as a principal bass player, but when Mazel came in, he moved him back into the section and brought in a fellow by the name of Hollingsworth from Texas. And now they have an assistant first bass player by the name of Turner, who's an absolute genius. I went to hear him solo a couple of weeks ago, and he made the bass sound like a cello and a viola. It was just unbelievable. This is the first time in the history of Pittsburgh that we ever had a bass viol solo concert, and this occurred in 1991. So that the times are changing. The Pittsburgh Symphony now has a woman first bassoon, a woman first oboe, and a woman
cello.
Well, it's had cello for a number of years, and it's also had a woman as the first Mrs. Harth at the second violin section. But to get a woman to be the first bassoon, and a woman to be the first flute, or the first oboe, and a woman to be the first trombone, And now a woman bass player is a phenomenon that I never thought I would live to see. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting because it's obvious that they have the skills that command this kind of position. Because when the symphony started, it was lucky if they made $6,000 a year. They now started something like $52,000.
That's right.
And it's unbelievable.
How come blacks haven't made more progress?
No, that's the tragedy of the times. The blacks have never been given a significant opportunity in American symphonic performance. We had a black bass player by the name of Bill Lewis, who was a teacher at the junior high school, who was absolutely the best bass player in the city of Pittsburgh from at least 1945 to 1970, and never allowed to play in the symphony. The best he could do was the Nixon Orchestra and eventually the Opera Orchestra, and now retired. Joe Ross is in the second violin section, and he was taking his master's degree at the Pittsburgh Symphony, second violin in the Pittsburgh Symphony. That was the second black, the first black being Patricia Stratus Jennings, the piano player. So it's to this day. Then we had a wonderful young man who came to Pittsburgh in 1991 as a cello player, and he left in 1991 to go to the Boston Symphony. He had a master's degree out of Yale, and so he was well prepared. And it's significant that he left Pittsburgh for Boston, which still is the greatest orchestra in this country.
What do you want to tell us about?
I'm at Ursuline Center over in the Bloomfield Garfield area. That's a fascinating story from my standpoint, because what happened is Barbara Shore, who's a professor of social work at the University of Pittsburgh.
I know her well.
And she has always known that I would love to help people. And so back in 1981, she invited me to sit on the board of directors of the Ursuline Center because they were building a home for people who had to come to Pittsburgh while their members of their family were receiving a significant medical attention, including transplants. And Ursuline Center on South Winebiddle Street had a house on their property that had formerly been a home for resident nuns, and they were converting that to what is now called the Family House. And so Barbara invited me to see if I could help pull that together. It was a lovely experience, because Sister Elaine Eckert, E-C-K-E-R-T, was a very bright woman. Ursuline was owned by a group of nuns in Louisville, Kentucky.
Ursuline is a Catholic.
Ursuline is a Catholic school, community center on South Winebiddle Street in Bloomfield. And they have a nice contract with the various federal agencies for finding jobs for people and doing other things. But my function was to find furniture and help build this family house. We built this family house for $150,000 in the same year in which the University of Pittsburgh was creating a similar facility on McKee Place, backed by the Rooneys and the Steelers, for $2.5 million. Mm-hmm. We were able to create 20 beds mm-hmm. for $150,000. And they were able to create, I think, 35 or 40 beds for $2.5 million. I have to gloat about that experience. And one of the things I was able to do was to be able to hustle four tires for the Ursuline vehicle to move these people back and forth to Presbyterian or West Penn or wherever else their patients were. And the four tires were a gift of Don Allen Chevrolet, because I called Chuck Walker and said that they needed four tires for the van, and he was gracious enough to make the gift. It was exciting because we accomplished a minor miracle on the wall.
Cuyahoga Ward.
There it is, back there. See
I
that?
Didn't know what Cuyahoga Ward. Tell me again.
Now, there's the Cuyahoga Ward.
Yeah, it's K-O...
A-C-H. And the young people that ever use this, all the other Jewish kids, call it coax. I laugh.
Did you get that?
I won that 1980 something. See, the Cuyahoga Ward was originally
1989.
Yeah. What happened? That was there was a fellow by the name of S.J. Novin. And S.J. Novin was childless. And S.J. Novin spoke with a Litvak accent you could cut with a knife.
Uh-huh.
And he always was talking about Koya. And he published, after Milt Sussman died, he published the Y Weekly.
Oh, I didn't remember that.
Yeah. So, but what he did was, because he knew the foundations, he put $2,000 into the Pittsburgh Foundation for scholarship aid. To this day, I would love to show you Foundation book, which I
dropped your voice.
So anyhow, he created this Cuyahoga Ward.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody did. It's called S.J. Novin's Cuyahoga Ward. Mm-hmm. Childless. This is a marvelous book. A real down on the street.
What sort of business had he?
He was selling paper to printing companies. A small operator. You asked about the Spectrum Award.
Yes. Well, you mentioned the writer, the Chronicle, the editor.
Milt Sussman.
Milt Sussman. Do you want to say a word about him?
I think that would be interesting. Yeah, because there was a lawyer that never made a living as a lawyer that made a tremendous contribution as a citizen.
Yeah. That's right. He taught at.
Did other things.
Yeah.
Number one. Oh, are we on the machine?
Yes, you're on the machine.
Oh, my God. I'm not sure you heard me.
No, I heard.
Did you hear it all right?
I hope.
Because, Milt Sussman was quite an interesting character. His wife was also attorney, and she came from Butler. But he spent the last 25 years of his life that I knew him as a real significant... I hate to call him a do-gooder, but that's
do-gooder.
What he was.
Do-gooder and a professional Jew.
Yeah, professional Jew who really taught for no fees. He edited the YMHA Weekly for no fee. He edited the Jewish Outlook. If he ever made a living, it was a modest living, and yet he was able to make a significant contribution. They had one son who was a successful rabbi, he just was a man that was able to do a lot of good. We tangled once or twice. I want to forget what the reason was, but I presume that my aggressions in the social service arena could have disturbed him.
Anyone.
Really?
Sure.
Really?
From time to time, was I a threat?
Yeah. Well, why was that? Tell me. Get a feeling.
Before we leave today, I'd like to get a feeling of what you think was your greatest contribution?
What's your legacy?
What do you think of all of these wonderful things you've done, accomplished? What are you proudest of, most of all?
I would have to say that I'm proudest of having set an example for my children and others of the importance of putting back in the society, giving back in some small measure. The great bounty that I've enjoyed. After I had done this for years, I discovered that this was the feeling of Andrew Carnegie. This was the feeling of other poor people who became wealthy and made it their business to share with others their bounty. I noticed in this day and age dozens of people using that same language. And I have to be comfortable and pleased that the mantle has been passed. I know that both of my daughters take a significant interest in the community and give of themselves. I read a poem that my youngest granddaughter wrote about her family for school as a senior in high school in Florida, and one thing she mentioned is the importance of giving of herself to charities by her mother in Florida. Not a lot of money, but a great deal of herself. Sally, my Pittsburgh daughter, is a vice president of the Jewish Community Center, holds a full-time job, this to me is the most significant contribution I could have made. I would say that had I set out, in my present state of mind, had I set out to set a program, it would be to pass on to my children this willingness to help others. And in that, I've been lucky and successful. Now, can they do the same for their children? I can't answer, and I don't know that I have that responsibility. I just showed my grandchildren yesterday why I feel so strongly about trade unions when I showed them the Post-Gazette story about the Homestead Pinkerton fight of 1892.
It. We all read it.
See,
yeah.
it's a sad story, but it's a matter of, and I won't even go to Mr. Frick's house and pay $5 to see the affluence with which he lived because he was a bad, bad person. He gave us the park. He gave us great number of other things he could never pay back for all the harm and all the bad that he did. And this, to me, is the epitome of what I would like to stand for. Mm-hmm.
Have you any idea whether Frick or his like thought they were doing good or bad?
Mr. Carnegie knew he was doing good. Mr. Frick didn't give a damn. Mr. Frick never did consciously do something that was good. To pay back for the harm that he did. I don't believe.
No.
I've never seen
any. We have no way of knowing.
No, there's no way. Of course, you have to give his daughter credit because she's attempted to embellish his life built and gave the Frick Museum to the University of Pittsburgh campus, created the fabulous museum in New York City with the Frick Art Collection, created a third gallery here on Reynolds Street in Pittsburgh with all of her paintings. She obviously had a motivation to try to erase the bad image that her father had, and for that you must give her a great deal of credit. She happens to have been a cousin to a dear friend of mine, Richard Wright, and he said she was a very pleasant person, Richard having been on his mother's side a Frew, F-R-E-W, and a relative and a cousin to Helen Clay Frick. And he said that she deliberately knew what she was doing as she made these gifts and was attempting to embellish her father's image in the community, which she obviously has succeeded in doing, because I might be one of the few people you'll ever run into who will still speak so harshly of Henry Clay Frick.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a special Jewish legacy or a special Jewish feeling for this kind of public service or interest?
I found out many years after I had started this that this had historical Jewish imperatives, but they were never part of my training. And the only training that I had was that of my parents setting an example of building a better world. And I literally translated building a better world because I had the college education and the advanced education, that building a better world to me meant giving back, having nothing to do with being Jewish.
Yeah, maybe that's what your parents took from Judaism themselves.
Well, I'm not sure that that wasn't. I think that the building of a better world was part of their soul and their character. The answer of your question on the imperative.
You put on your father's tombstone.
Yes, I had the pleasure back in 1960 of making the eulogy for my father. He wouldn't have a rabbi, even though many rabbis were his friends, and they all came around after he died to see if I would sustain his level of giving to them. So in the eulogy, I had a chance to really say some things about him. But on his tombstone, I put down this eulogy to my father: social justice and a better world were his creed, his ideal, his life. And that to me symbolized the man. I suppose that I would be prideful in trying to emulate some of the things that he was able to do and hopefully pass on to, again, a third generation some of this which I have been lucky enough to have happen. I don't know what else one can do.
I think you've done beautifully.